Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another edition of Mind Shift Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Dr. Clint Haycock, welcoming you to this fantastic discussion with Dr. Daryl Ray. He is a psychologist. He is also the founder of both the Recovering From Religion Foundation as well as the Secular Therapy Project, both of which we're going to be talking about in a few minutes in this episode. And you know, the more I think about it, the more I reflect on my own experiences and that of my family. I've really come to believe in both of these concepts that, first of all, if you're like me, born into evangelicalism or born into a cult or whatever sort of religion you may have come out of, you've got to recover from that experience. And to me, that is the ultimate irony, that we have to actually recover from religion. I mean, think about it for a minute. All the things that religion promised us. I remember when I was a pastor, I said all those things. I preached it. I taught it. I've said it many times when I was a pastor, you need to become the person that God made you to be. The longer you are a Christian, the more Christ-like you will become. You'll be more forgiving. You'll be more loving. And just think about it. It stands to reason, doesn't it? This process that Christians call sanctification, it is a lifelong process whereby you are supposed to become more and more and more like Christ. You're becoming more Christ-like. You should become more forgiving, more loving, more accepting, more kind and tolerant and all these wonderful things. If that were true, however, we see in so many cases, person after person in the church, Christians treat each other Christians, absolutely horribly, and they treat outsiders terribly too. I've just come back from a trip to the States. I was in Seattle for 3 weeks, one of the weekends, the middle weekend of July. My sister Valerie and I, we drove up to Canada to meet up with Neil 604, the Canadian atheist. He was on my show a few months ago. We were supposed to be doing a live YouTube thing on the Saturday night, but unfortunately we weren't able to put it together. However, we had a fantastic pub lunch in New Westminster, just south of Vancouver, BC. Neil came out, of course, Janice Selby and her husband, Stacey Ray, was there. And it was interesting that I reflected that all these people that I've met somehow are a result of me doing the podcast. Some of the guests that I've had on the show, some of multiple guests, Stacey, my sister Val, and Janice have all been on the show twice. Neil's been on it once. And none of this would have happened without doing this podcast. So it's a really cool thing that it's kind of like forming a new tribe. But all of us, as we sat around the table, there were people from Canada, from the States as well. You know, we reflected on how damaging religion has been in our lives. And this is something my sister and I talked about a lot as I was staying out with her that week. And we were reflecting on how we've been watching our family and specifically our oldest sister basically destroy. She's a total fundamentalist. Watching her destroy every last relationship with the rest of my sisters. She did a bunch of stuff while I was there. First of all, she blanked me. She unfriended me on Facebook. She alienated one of the very last sisters and her husband that were still speaking to her. She confronted them over the fact that they were now going to hell because they don't go to church anymore. I was talking to her daughter, my niece, and she's living at their house rent-free, but it's basically emotional blackmail because my sister has told her, you can live here for free because I know you're struggling financially. However, the catch is you have to go to our church, and she hates it, but she has to do it because she has no choice. And I said, this is nothing more than emotional blackmail, and I've reflected. This is something Valerie and I talked about a lot. We reflected on the amount of damage that religion, specifically Christianity, has done to our family and still is doing. And I see this all the time, and I hear this from a lot of people who have come out of not just Christianity, but other religions, world religions, cults, and so forth. So to me, it is the supreme irony. Something that promises so much ends up delivering religious trauma and abuse of all sorts, spiritual abuse, sexual abuse, that we have to recover from. And this is something that Daryl and I are going to get into in a few minutes. And then there's this other piece, this Secular Therapy Project, which is something also I believe in. I think that going to a Christian therapist, and again, this is something we're going to get into, why you should avoid going to a Christian therapist, a specifically Christian therapist, to deal with your religious trauma and all the crap that you might be dealing with coming out of religion. Avoid him or her like the plague, and Daryl Ray will explain why in a few minutes. So I think this is something that's really important. If you need therapy, you need to find someone who's operating according to basically secular principles, and this is what the Secular Therapy Project is all about. So I hope you enjoy this chat with me and Daryl Ray. Let's go on into it as we talk about what it's all about, what it means to have to recover from religion. I'm happy to be joined by Daryl Ray, who is the president of the Recovering from Religion Foundation, as well as the author of the book, The God Virus. Thank you for joining me on Mindshift Podcast, Daryl.
Well, good to have me, Kim. I'm glad you have me. thanks for inviting me. I don't know what I'm saying.
Well, welcome. Let's just put it that way. Welcome to the show. Well, I'm glad you were able to get a hold of me because I think you sent me an email. It was about 3 weeks ago. And we made the connection through Janice Selby, because isn't that right? You're going to be a part of her conference next year in Canada,
right?
So she's invited you to come across. Where are you located? You're coming from the States now, aren't you?
Right, I'm in the Kansas City area, right smack dab in the middle of the continent.
So how did you make the connection with Janice in the first place?
Well, Janice contacted me because I wrote The God Virus, and I'm the president of Recovering from Religion. We deal with religious trauma all the time. And we train all of our volunteers to spot it and help people, refer them to licensed therapists to deal with the PTSD aspects of religious recovery. So, I mean, I'm pretty much in the center of what she's looking at for her conference next year in religious trauma recovery.
That's a huge thing. It is absolutely huge, isn't it?
Yeah.
What do you find, just in sort of general terms, who are the sort of, is there a demographic generally that comes to your foundation coming out of what a particular religion, Christianity, or is it more of all faiths, cults? What is it?
Well, you know, every chat or phone call we get is anonymous. So we collect no data on anyone. However, I can say the majority of the people that are coming to us are pretty much straight Christian, maybe fundamentalist Christian. And then we've got a significant portion that are ex-JWs, ex-Jehovah's Witnesses, we have quite a few ex-Mormons come to us. We also have a lot, probably in the neighborhood of 15 to 20% of the people that call in or chat in are ex-Muslim. And they're oftentimes chatting from Pakistan or Tunisia or the UK. We get ex-Muslims from Canada and the UK as well. So we get, I mean, it's a wide, wide range. We even get ex-Hindus from India. But that's pretty rare. I wouldn't say we get more than a few a year ex-Hindus. But we sure do get a lot of ex-Muslims and ex-Mormons. We don't get a whole lot of ex-Scientologists. But people who are just leaving whatever religion they were brought up in, they have to deal with a lot of issues. It may not be trauma, but they do have to deal with the issues of being rejected by their family. We also deal with a lot of people calling and chatting in with us. They're LGBTQIA, and they're trying to deal with the fact that their parents kicked them out of their house, or they've been disowned because they came out as gay, or they're being disowned because they came out as atheist. It's crazy, Clint, but we have lots of people that will accept their religious people that will accept their kids as gay, but will not accept them as atheists. And we have a lot of gay people coming to us and saying, you know, I'm having a harder time telling my parents I'm gay, I'm atheist than I had when I came out as gay. So you name it, we deal with it. We've got at recoveringfromreligion.org, we've got a massive amount of resources. We've got dozens of volunteers that are trained and can take phone calls and take chats online, and then they can point you towards a good therapist.
Right. So it sounds like it's a very comprehensive service that your organization offers.
We just had a chat come in today. A guy was telling us, well, I assume a guy, I don't know if he's male or female, was telling us that he suffered religious abuse. And when we asked our agent, asking what was your religious abuse, he said people would stand up in church and pray for me. And in praying for me, basically condemn me and tell everybody in the whole congregation how what a horrible person I was under the auspices of praying for them. I mean, that's social ostracism right there, you know. I'm going to stand up and pray for you, Clint, and I'm going to tell the whole congregation you're gay and you're going to hell and you're not following Jesus' word and, oh, we love you, you know. It's just that's what this guy was or this person was experiencing. And well, I'm glad he found us. I'm glad they found us because it's abuse. And they recognize that as abuse, and they're coming to us to get some help with that.
It's a good thing this person, yeah, reached out and found your organization. Do you find that there's sort of common threads from religion to religion? This is something that Chris Shelton and I, we've been talking about this a lot between my podcast and being on his show. His argument is basically that if you strip away the ideology from most of these religions and cults and sects, what you find is the base pattern in terms of trauma and abuse is very, very similar. Do you find that's true in all the clients you've dealt with over the years? There's common patterns?
Yeah, well, I'm a psychologist, and for decades I've dealt with people who are dealing with trauma of all kinds. And of course, PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome, has common threads to it no matter what. Dr. Marlene Winnell came up with this notion of religious trauma about 10 years ago or so. She and I were corresponding when she introduced me to the idea. I'd never heard of it before. And what she noticed was what you're saying right now. There's a common thread. It really doesn't matter whether you're raised Hindu or Muslim or Mormon or Baptist. Doesn't matter. The methodologies are successful. And if they weren't successful, they wouldn't be used. And what these religions have all done is identified specific psychological techniques that help people get infected, just like brainwashing techniques. I mean, when the Korean War happened, the Koreans used specific brainwashing techniques that had been designed in the Soviet Union. Now, this is, I think it's a fascinating story from a psychological perspective. If you've ever taken a course in psychology, then you had to learn about conditioned response and operant conditioning and all that sort of stuff. And you learned about a guy named Pavlov. And he was a great Russian psychologist. And what we know was everything Pavlov was doing with dogs, you know, you ring the bell, the dog salivates. You can train a dog to salivate at the ring of a bell. If you give him a treat, just give him a treat, ring the bell, give him a treat. Sooner or later, that dog will anticipate the treat with saliva. Well, that's a pretty basic form of programming. And Pavlov discovered this and was able to use it. But what we don't, and you know, we understood what was going on from that point of view. However, when communism took over, especially when Stalin got in, Pavlov, we lost sight of Pavlov. Nobody knows. It was like the Iron Curtain went down over the Soviet Union, but yet Pavlov continued to do his work. But we in the West had no access to what he was doing. And what Pavlov was doing was still working with dogs. But there was a big accident that happened one time in Pavlov's laboratory. What he saw was, and this is all relevant to religion, Clint. I'm not going off on too deep an end here.
Yeah, you're getting there. You're getting there.
Yeah, I'm getting there.
You got to go to Russia first.
they had a flood. Now, this all happened after the Iron Curtain went down. So we did not know about this. We only knew about this decades later after the Soviet Union fell. They had a flood. And of course, the dogs are in danger of drowning. And some dogs did drown. Other dogs were traumatized because while they didn't drown, they saw their other dogs drowning. And they themselves were up to their nose and could barely breathe. I mean, there was, you know, it lasted for, I guess, a few days. And when they could get back into the laboratory and rescue what dogs they had, what they found was many, many of the dogs that had gone through this experience had a change in personality. They literally had new personalities, different personalities. It gave Pavlov the idea, can we change the personality of a dog by exposing the dog to high stress situations? And he started experimenting with this. Well, is this starting to sound familiar? Well, so what happens was Pavlov learns that you can do this. Well, what happened was Stalin actually liked Pavlov. Pavlov hated Stalin, but Stalin liked Pavlov. Why? Because Pavlov's doing shit that Stalin wants to know about. So Stalin starts putting graduate students into Pavlov's laboratory. Pavlov had no idea these people were spies, but he thought they were just his students or graduate students. And they're all sitting there learning, and they're experimenting with dogs, and they're all learning specific ways to force behavioral personality changes in dogs. Well, what these people then do is go out and start applying these techniques to humans in the psychiatric wards of the Soviet Union against political resistors.
Unbelievable. So anyone who was deemed an enemy of the state or an enemy of Stalin was considered fair game to be basically used and abused. It kind of reminds me of some of the stuff that was going on in Nazi Germany in the concentration camps.
These techniques, they perfected these techniques. We now, our popular term is brainwashing. But brainwashing is really a sophisticated set of techniques that include putting an individual under high-stress situations for extended periods of time until they literally reprogram their brain. They have to in order to survive in that environment, or they may die. So it's a reasonable thing to happen. The Koreans then picked up the Soviet techniques and started using the Soviet techniques on American servicemen who had been captured during the Korean War, and they get American servicemen to get on film and confess to all their capitalist sins or whatever it was. And the United States government's starting to think, well, how do they get our guys, really strong-willed guys, to confess to these things? And only years after the Korean War did they found out. There was a great book called The Battle of the Mind by a guy named William Sargent, a British MI5 guy, I believe he was, psychiatrist. And he discovered all these techniques. And now we now know that you can stress somebody into personality change or into high levels of fear.
Right, yes, I understand. I've read also Lifton's Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism, which interviewed a lot of ex-servicemen who were survivors of these communist Chinese prison camps. But now, how does that relate to religion and specifically religious trauma?
Okay, now let's fast forward to religion, because every fundamentalist religion especially puts children in high-stress situations. If you think about it, if you're being told from the day you're born that you're a worthless piece of shit because of this original sin idea, or you're going to hell, and you're going to get, and your parents beat you for having asked the wrong question in Sunday school class, or your parents beat you for catching you masturbating, or just being a human being, that's all you have to be. How many years of this, from 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, children are being subjected to this? Especially in fundamentalist kinds of religion, or in highly controlling cultures like Islam in, say, Saudi Arabia, or Hinduism in, central India, when women could be beaten to death and raped because they, had a boyfriend outside of marriage. We're seeing, and we now understand, that a lot of these people were traumatized. And in fact, it's so common, it's so ridiculously common, that we can look back and I can talk to somebody for a few minutes and just ask them a few questions about their childhood and probably make an educated guess that they currently experience some kind of behavioral effects of the trauma they had when they were much younger. They don't know it. It's not aware to them. They don't know why they still feel guilty when they have sex with their wife or with their husband. But it doesn't take too long to find out that the way they were taught in the purity culture, for example, girls are taught from the time they're really young that you're totally responsible for what boys think. And if you dress wrong and they sin or they rape you, it's because you tempted them. Again, that's a traumatic message to be giving people.
Well, here's a question. Does this religious trauma affect every single person within religion? Because you could make the case maybe that we all, if we were a part of any religion, we've all suffered religious trauma.
I'm not saying everybody is traumatized by this. Some people seem to be able to get through it, say, screw this and move on. But there's too high a percentage. And I can't put a percentage on it, of course. I just know that if you've been through the Baptist purity culture in the United States for the first 15 years of your life, you're probably going to have some residual effects, no matter how strong you are. So that answer, exactly. That's a long answer to your question.
That's a long answer.
I bet you didn't know about Pavlov, did you?
Well, no, I knew about Pavlov. In fact, I was going to say I read Robert Lifton's Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism, which is exactly describing what you just talked about in the fact that he was in Hong Kong just shortly after the Korean War, and he interviewed a lot of not just American servicemen, but it was Europeans, too, that lived in China as well. Because the Chinese were obviously part of this as well, the brainwashing. That's one of the books that really triggered it for me, because coming out of my own background in fundamentalist Christianity, and I say now, I was part of a cult. I was part of the Bill Gothard cult when I was a kid. My parents raised us as according to his teachings, and I view it, it's a total cult. And when I started reading Lifton, that's when the light started coming on, because as you say, when he goes through all the markers of brainwashing and then at the end of the book starts rolling it into the world of the cults, that's when I thought all these tactics have been used on me and obviously many other people. Right. And that's why I've been so fascinated by the world of the cults and religious trauma, because I see it as it's my own project. I'm working on myself. And yet, there's so many other people, as you say, that are right in that ballpark that are coming out of that background who are triggered and affected and traumatized and all this by the crap that we had to live through.
Right. My third book was called The God Virus. And the whole thesis of The God Virus is that religion finds methodologies, memes, if you will, that work. It's like any living organism. In order to survive, all of my ancestors had to have the right adaptations to the environment that they were in. Well, religion's the same way. A religion has to adapt to the environment it's in, or it will not survive. So it's an evolution. Mormonism evolves. Baptist today. I mean, think of this. The United States Southern Baptist Church was founded in support of slavery before the U.S. Civil War. Now, that's a pretty nasty thing to found a Christian church on, but that was its foundations. It wasn't until 1979 that they disavowed that. But just this week, literally yesterday, the Southern Baptists were debating whether they should condemn white nationalist supremacy in the United States. Now, and what planet are these folks on? But that's how they now realize that the culture has moved on. They can no longer quietly espouse white supremacy from their pulpits. And a few people, especially a couple black ministers, are calling them on this shit. And they're saying, you know, we can't be a Southern Baptist if you're going to keep supporting these white nationalists. And the white nationalists, this whole thing was a debate. And the committee, the subcommittee for the Baptist Convention, quashed the resolution to condemn it. Condemn white nationalism. Wow. So, of course, there was a big backlash around this. Well, while the backlash is happening, the white nationalists are coming out on Twitter and say, you know, great for the Southern Baptist Church. They're standing up for white nationalism.
Happy days.
Happy days. Because there's a hell of a lot of Southern Baptists that are white supremacists. And they hate that we call them that, but they are.
That's what they are.
These black ministers have called the Southern Baptists on their shit and saying, look, you guys keep supporting white nationalists and white supremacists. Well, they finally got it out of committee. They finally got the committee to revise it. And the one thing I think I read just this morning, the one thing they've changed in it was the Southern Baptists had this notion of Ham, you know, the curse of Ham.
Yeah, that's where came that? The blacks. Yeah, oh yeah, yeah, that's where right. black people came from.
So they would not accept the resolution the way the black minister had written it. So they modified it, basically kept it the same, except they took out that we disavow the curse of Ham. They took that out. Now, they could have left that in and just say, we no longer believe that. But they didn't. They left it in. They took it out. Now, the black minister says, okay, I wish they left it in, but I can live with it. But what the fuck? Why in the hell are they keeping, even hinting that they still believe or agree with that whole notion of the curse of Ham?
Maybe so it's their dog whistle to their white nationalist pastors, though, and parishioners.
Yeah, it may
be. They've got to keep that in there.
Right.
But without a mass exodus.
You look at the way churches have to, the church has to evolve. Just like, you know, a bird in my environment has to evolve against all the diseases and parasites if it's going to survive and replicate. And so do I as a human, as an organism. Churches have to too. So you see that as the culture changes, the religion has to change too.
Exactly. So they have to change. They have to adapt or they're not going to survive. But of course, as we see, they're often behind the eight ball, aren't they? They're never on the cutting edge, it seems like, of societal change. They're always lagging behind the times and reacting. Isn't that the case?
Now, the religion's almost always behind the curve. For example, the Mormon Church wouldn't even let black men, of course, only men can be priests, only black men, they didn't let black men to be priests until 1979. Well, why'd they do that? Well, because the Mormon Church is starting to really look bad. Well,
yeah,
that's kind of where
step with the times. Yeah.
And that's kind of where the Baptist Church is right now. It's kind of where the Mormon Church is with the whole LGBTQ and trans rights stuff. The Mormon Church is still resisting, even though they're changing, they're constantly changing the wording. Of course, the wording is always nicer and kinder, but the basic principle is we don't really want you.
Well, what sort of pushback do these churches and cults receive? How does society perceive them when they make a change like that?
The biggest backlash the Mormons had a couple of years ago was when they said that children of gay people cannot be part of the church. Wow, you know, that been a huge uproar. And they just backtracked on that about 2 months ago, the Mormon church.
How
so
convenient.
Now, yeah, it's amazing. The Mormon church is probably the best example of evolutionary biology at work. The Mormons, for example, were polygamists.
I was going to bring that up.
Yeah, John.
Joseph Smith.
Joseph Smith had 38 wives. Brigham Young had 52 wives. Of course, they deny all that, but there's.
But it was part of their official doctrine.
Absolutely. And the
revelation from God.
And they wanted to become a state. And the United States Congress says, until you get rid of polygamy, you can't become a state. So amazing. God came down and gave a revelation to the president.
Says,
get rid of polygamy, which they did, and they were admitted as a new state. I believe it was in 1890. They became a new state or something like that. So God is always speaking to these people. And you see today, the Baptists are saying, yeah, God may be telling us not to endorse this white nationalist stuff anymore. Even though the Southern Baptist has been the massive center of this whole white supremacy. And now they're starting to see the handwriting on the wall.
I was going to say they've got huge skeletons in their closet as well as the sexual abuse stuff that they've been covering up for years too. So the SBC's got huge issues as well as the nationalism thing. Well, I wanted to go back to what you were talking about earlier. I was just talking on a recent podcast with Conway and Siegelman. I don't know if you're familiar with their work, their book Snapping and their book Holy Terror. This Snapping was written in 1978. It came out about 6 months before the Jonestown tragedy. Then Holy Terror came out, I think, in 1982 or 1983. And it's a study of Christian fundamentalism and its involvement with the political scene in America, starting with the Reagan sort of years, the religious right, Jerry Falwell, Moral Majority, guys like that. But what they talk about is this issue of snapping. You were describing the sudden personality changes that people have in these religions, cults, sects, when they're when they undergo really heavy psychological and existential pressure, they can snap in a way, and they become almost a new person. Now, I've seen it in the sense of what I call, you know, evangelical religious conversion experiences, but we see it in the cults too, obviously. What happens when psychologically to a person who snaps, in the words of Conway and Siegelman, and then they actually talk about in what they call information disease, which that now you're open, you're susceptible to the cult programming, and it actually does neurological damage. The chanting, the prayers, the liturgy, the tongues, all these repetitious things. It actually, I'm interested to hear what happens from a psychological point of view. How do you help people that are coming out of that?
Well, I don't help people in the sense of doing psychotherapy. I don't do that. I don't do that anymore.
Your organization, isn't it?
But our organization does. And what we do is we train our volunteers to listen very carefully when people chat in to certain key words or key experiences. You know, not everybody needs psychotherapy. Not everybody needs it a lot, by a long shot. And it's not available to everybody either. So what we do is we listen to these key words and phrases, and depending upon what we see there, that we recommend resources to people. So, you know, a person who just left a church is going to need different resources than somebody who's been an atheist for the last 20 years. And it's fascinating to me that people who've been... So I've been an atheist for 20 years, somebody will tell us, or 10 years, and I'm still bothered by fear of hell. Well, we have resources to help people deal with the fear of hell, because that's really a symptom of religious trauma. Why should you be...
Phobia, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very related, very much related to phobia. And then one thing that happened about back in 2012, 2011, after I published The God Virus, and then I was published my next book, Sex and God, people were calling me, they were emailing me, texting me, I need help. I couldn't help everybody. And I just can't. So what I did was I started an organization called the Secular Therapy Project. It's actually a part of our Recovering from Religion organization. But what I found was that people need therapy and they can't find a good therapist. And the reason they can't find a good therapist is because there's so many damn Christian counselors out there.
I was asking about that.
Yeah. And they don't know what they're doing, and they're very poorly trained. And their real goal is to get you back into church or to get you to believe their particular version of Jesus. They're not psychological. They don't understand the psychology, and they don't understand brain function. They don't understand trauma. None of that stuff. And they're marriage and family counselors, and they're child therapists, and it's horrible. So what we did was start this organization, and it's now being run by our director, Dr. Caleb Lack and Samantha Carlton. They run that part of our organization. He's the director. And what they do is they vet therapists so that we know that they're secular. We know they're really well evidenced, and they use well-trained, and they use evidence-based methods.
So anybody who gets a hold of the Secular Therapy Project, they can be assured that they've all been vetted. They're not Christian therapists. They have methods-based techniques, as you're saying. What happens then when a person registers with the organization?
You can get online, go to seculartherapy.org, register as a client, and you don't have to even give your real name. Anonymity is important, so we respect that. And then you can search our database, and we have almost 400 therapists. We actually have several in the United Kingdom. We have a lot in Canada. We have therapists in Australia and South Africa. I think we're in seven different countries now. We've got 400 therapists. You can search and find a therapist near you. Now, if you can't if you can't find a therapist near you, some therapists will do Skype sessions, just like you and I are doing right now. So you can get online. You can Skype with somebody who's 1,000 miles away from you and probably get almost as good a service from a therapist by Skype. I mean, I'm looking at you right now on the camera, and we're about as close as we appear to my neurological system, about as close as if you were sitting in my office.
We could be sitting across from each other. Yeah. The fact that I'm in the UK and you're in the States means really nothing now, doesn't it?
Yeah, it doesn't. So there's less and less barriers to people getting good psychotherapy. So I want to encourage your listeners, if you need therapy, fear of hell or trauma, or even just regular life stuff. It's not just around religion. It's well-trained therapists use evidence-based methods. And that's what our therapists do.
It is critical, because I've talked to several people now on this podcast about their experiences with specifically Christian counselors or therapists. And as you say, a lot of damage was done. It's funny, because one gal I had on here recently, she became an atheist. Part of that deconstruction and becoming an atheist was going to a specifically Christian counselor, because what he was doing, as you say, he was propping up the patriarchal sort of biblical narrative and, you know, telling her, well, this is your problem. You need to submit to your husband and you need to go down that sort of line and spank your children and all the rest of it, because that's what the Bible says. And when she started pushing back against what the therapist was telling her, that's what led her to start researching things like corporal punishment and the psychological damage and a more secularist perspective. And she thought, why am I part of a system that teaches this sort of stuff?
Yeah.
That was sort of the key that unlocked the door in her worldview of questioning then everything. So yeah. In a way, the Christian therapist did her a favor, unwittingly, of course. He wasn't trying to make her an atheist, you know.
Yeah.
But right. He pushed her hard enough. She started pushing back and said, this is bullshit. I'm out of here.
Yeah, but think of all the millions, literally millions of hours and thousands of people that are being treated to this horrible treatment. Now, if I went to that therapist, whoever this therapist was, and I needed treatment for depression, the very treatment you just told me about wouldn't cure my depression. It would make it worse.
Exactly.
I mean, why am I depressed? Why am I depressed? I'm depressed because my husband beats me or berates me or tells me that I'm worthless or he rapes me or, you know, why wouldn't
whatever
a person
abuse it is.
Yeah, whatever abuse it is. And so I go into a counselor and a counselor says, well, your problem is you're not submitting enough. I know ex-fundamentalist women who did everything they could, short of being, well, maybe even being a slave to their husband, and it still did no good. It just made the behavior worse.
Made it worse.
Yeah. So going to a Christian counselor is about the worst thing, literally is probably the worst thing you could do.
Well, and then you could dip into the spiritual realm too, because the Christian therapist could equally as well say, well, your problem is you've got unconfessed sin in your life. You've got demonic oppression. It could be anything along those theological or spiritual lines as well. I'm doubting my faith. Well, doubts are of the devil. So you've got to pray against that and you've got to come against that in the name of Jesus. I mean, you can hear it all now and it's magical thinking and all the rest of it. And like you say, it's just going to exacerbate the problem without actually getting to the root issues. Well, your husband's abusing you or whatever it is, your marriage is dysfunctional, or you're spiritually abused or sexually abused at your church. Well, of course it's going to manifest itself, psychologically, behaviorally, etc.
Well, I want to go to the next level where the hope is, because number one, we exist to give people hope and to give them avenues to get out of religion. But I am thrilled that we're starting to see things like Janice Selby starting the Religious Trauma Conference next year in Vancouver, Canada, to openly out loud talk about religious trauma. I see so many therapists that are afraid to talk about religion in the therapeutic environment. And what we're starting to see is that therapists are getting more sophisticated and understanding that PTSD is not just related to, were you in Iraq as a combatant or not? Or were you in Vietnam as a combatant? It's not all war related. We're now understanding that religion causes, your religion says beat your children. Well, if you beat your children, you're putting them in. I mean, a five-year-old who's being beaten has no way to understand that.
Yeah, you can't process that.
No.
You don't have the capacity to process that. Which is exactly what happened to me as a kid. We were talking about this with Janice Selby, the same kind of thing. That sort of trauma when watching horrific movies like A Thief in the Night when I was a kid and things like that, they were incredibly traumatic. Rapture anxiety, and I was going to lose my salvation. I was going to be left behind in the rapture. That causes huge psychological damage to a child.
Yep, it does. And you don't know how many people have told me exactly what you just said. Those movies traumatized them.
Absolutely.
They had nightmares for years. Even people who are long left religion still wake up with cold sweats around that one stupid movie. That movie probably did more harm than almost any preacher.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that's, I'm trying to go to the hopeful side. It's pretty dark.
I'm dragging you down here, Jared. I'm dragging you back into the shit.
So, you know, we've got this conference, which is the first time thing. It says that people are starting to pay attention. We have hundreds of people coming to us every month at Recovery from Religion to talk to us and chat with us because they're learning about us from just doing what we're doing right now, talking about Recovery from Religion. Or we've got volunteers that we had a hard time finding volunteers 10 years ago when we first started Recovery from Religion. Well, now we're getting, I would guess we're probably getting about a dozen new volunteers trained and ready to go every month or so. Now, not everybody sticks around, but that's a far cry from what in other words, we're getting a lot more help with what we're trying to achieve in recovering from religion. And the Secular Therapy Project, we have over 15,000 people who have found us and look for therapists as clients, and over 400 therapists. Well, we had none of that 10 years ago. 10 years ago, none of that existed. And it's hopeful. And we're starting to see the news media we're starting to see them talk about religious recovery. I mean, mainstream news media like The Atlantic or New York Times are carrying stories about religious recovery. Well, that's cool, because people are going to put two and two together sooner or later and say, well, I'm a victim of that too. How do I need to do?
I was going to say something about jumping in on that point, this issue of the dangers and the damage caused by religion and religionism. Because I talked to a guy last year, Dr. Hector Avalos, and he's kind of a pioneer of what they call this new wave, second new wave atheism, where you had guys like Hitchens and Sam Harris and Dawkins and all those guys. They're really big on, you know, arguing against proofs of God and the existence of God as atheists. But what Avalos and his colleagues are doing, it's all about telling people, look at the damage that religion has caused, not only historically. Of course, we can point to many, many religious wars, the Inquisition, and on and on and on. But yet, currently, what's happening, and this is kind of what you're describing, isn't it? This is, to me, the supreme irony, is that religion promised us peace and enlightenment and freedom and forgiveness and all this wonderful stuff. And it would be great if it were true, but what it delivers in so many cases is, you know, trauma and abuse and suffering and all kinds of problems. And it's so ironic that we have to recover from religion. That's supreme irony to me.
Yeah, it really is. And I do like Hector Avalos. I've followed him for years. I've met him a couple times at conferences. But there is another person, another Hector. I don't think you talked about to him, maybe, but Dr. Hector Garcia. Are you familiar with him and his books, Alpha God?
No, I haven't come across him yet, but it sounds like an interesting thing to pursue.
He's a psychologist, and he's one of the world's expert, literally one of the world's expert on treatment of PTSD. He's a good friend of mine. I love his books. I've had him at my house a couple of times. He's a really good guy down in San Antonio. In fact, I'm going to go see him in San Antonio in about 2 weeks. I'll be on the Atheist Experience.
All right. So you're going to be on his show?
No. And he's not. No, I'm just going to talk to him.
Right. Okay.
The Atheist Experience, I've been on the Atheist Experience. Are you familiar with that?
Oh, yeah. Matt Dillahunty.
Yeah. He's one of
I know those guys. Yeah.
Well, Matt, I'm going to be on with him in about 2 weeks with Matt Dillahunty, and I'll be on together. And we'll be on some other shows like Talk Heathen and Secular Sexuality Podcast. I'll be on all three of those down there in Austin. But the big news from our organization standpoint is we're doing a recovery retreat. We're calling it an excursion. It'll be in North Carolina in September. I believe it's September 22nd, 21st, 22nd, something like that. It will be the opposite of a church camp. It'll be very free-flowing, open. You don't have to go to anything if you don't want to.
But we have mandatory attendance.
No mandatory attendance.
No worship services.
Nothing like that. We'll have workshops if you want to attend them. We're going to have some interesting people there. Mandisa Thomas, the head of Black Nonbelievers, is going to be there as one of our guests. Sarah Roxdale is going to be there. She's a really big YouTube fashion person with some great, great videos on religious recovery and fear of hell. She came out of evangelical fundamentalist cult. So, you know, we're going to have some cool people like Lloyd Evans of the ex-Jehovah's Witness channel out of Croatia, although he's from the UK. So we're going to have some interesting people. We'll also have four psychotherapists there, one of whom, Candace Gorham, who wrote Ebony Exodus, the book on Black women leaving religion. She's going to be there. And the psychotherapist will be there just to kind of support people, not long term. I mean, we're not there to do psychotherapy. We're there to support people. And they'll be professionals, and they'll know what you're going through or help you figure out what you're going through. Anyway, we're excited about it. It'll be about 2.5 days of just being with other people who are going through the same crap you're going through. And you're going to learn a lot. You'll be able to rub shoulders with a lot of interesting and cool people. And, you know, I just hope people look it up, go to recoveringfromreligion.org and hit the button that says excursion and find out the details. And
you want to come?
Yeah.
Well, this is an interesting question. I've been thinking about this as you've been describing the damage that religion causes to so many people. Is there any use for religion in your perspective? Is there any point of view that you would say, you know what, it is okay, it is helping people? Because this seems to be an issue that people have some, they kind of skirt around it. Some would say, no, all religion is damaging and we should do away with all of it. Is there any place for religion in general, would you say? Or well, maybe spirituality? Maybe that's a question too.
I think there's a way to look at this that answers the question. And that is, in all my books, my minor was anthropology in my undergraduate, and I love anthropology. So when I wrote my books, I always went to cross-cultural analysis. So if you look at, for example, what's the sexuality of the Manganians in the South Pacific, and how does that compare to the sexuality of Christians in North America? And you'll find that there's radical differences, massive differences, because nothing about Christian sexuality matches what we really know about human sexuality. It's just bullshit, you know?
It's just abnormal, full stop.
Very abnormal. So what I'm saying is, if you just compare cultures and ask that very question, it doesn't matter what culture you're in. I mean, the last defense for religion is the question you just asked or implied. That, oh, there's got to be some role for spirituality. Oh, we need at least a little bit of religion.
Yeah, we're going to throw us a bone here. Yeah.
Do you need a little Hinduism? How about just a little bit of Saudi Arabian Wahhabism? You know, do you want just a little bit of Mormonism?
Fundamentalism, you know, or whatever it is.
If you ask a Baptist, would you like to see Mormonism disappear tomorrow? They'd probably say, yeah.
Yeah, it's a cult. We need to get rid of it.
Yeah. Would the world be better off without Mormonism? Now, Baptists say, yes, the world would be better off without Mormonism. Of course, they need to become Baptists. Ask a Catholic, do you think the world would be better off without Protestants? Hell yeah, we killed 30 million of them back in Europe in the 30 Years' War. They'd be better off without Protestants. So you ask each one of these religions, would the world be better off without your whatever the opposite religion is? And they'd all agree. So everybody agrees, the world would be better off without religion, except for my religion. So now let's go to Sweden and let's ask that question. Is the world better off with no religion? And Sweden's a pretty darn good example. They don't have hardly any religion there. Nobody goes to church.
Almost a completely secular country, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, they have the highest standard of living in the world, and equality, rates of pay, healthcare. It's a gun control, like unlike America, you know. So you don't hear about mass shootings in Sweden.
No, and just look at the quality of life. You can do a very, very detailed analysis of quality of life and religiosity, and they're inversely related. The more religious a society is, the lower their quality of life. I mean, what's the quality of life of a woman in Saudi Arabia?
It's very low.
Yeah.
Barely even able to drive a car. Yeah.
Right. What's the quality of life of a black person in Mississippi?
Good.
The fact is, in the United States, you could do a graph, and it's I've seen the graph. I can't remember where I found it, but look at the economic prosperity of a state and graph that against its religiosity. The higher the religiosity is, the lower, with one exception, and that's Utah. The Mormons seem to be able to overcome that. But Mississippi hasn't. Alabama hasn't. Look at Massachusetts or Vermont. You know, high standard of living and quality of life. And you can do it for just the states, or you can do it for the entire world. Is Bangladesh, because of its religion, prosperous? Hell no. Religion is probably what holds it back. You can make pretty good arguments that the less religion you have in a society, I'll refer back in some ways to my book, The God Virus. Think of religion as a parasite. An organism that has a high parasite load is going to be unhealthy. It's because it's feeding a lot of parasites. If you've got a giant tapeworm in your intestines, or if you've got a malaria plasmodium in your bloodstream, those are parasites. And they're sucking the energy out of your body. And they can ultimately kill you or weaken you so much that you'll be susceptible to other diseases. That's what religion is. Religion is a parasite load on the social fabric. The higher the parasite load, the less energy the social fabric has to be prosperous and to grow. So there's a high parasite load of in Mississippi of religion. There's a high parasite load in Saudi Arabia and in central India. You just look at where the most religious places are and use the parasite methodology, you can see that it just drags a culture down. I mean, think about where would we be today if the Catholic Church had not parasitized Europe for 1,000 years? Where would science be today? Would Galileo have been put on house arrest if we had the Catholic Church didn't have it? We didn't have that parasite. Galileo would have been able to advertise his discovery that there are moons around Jupiter. But no, he got put under house arrest.
Yeah, held science back, as you say. One of the ironies when I was studying the Spanish Inquisition was that I didn't realize this, but they said when there was this mass exodus of Jews from southern Spain into parts of Europe, that unintentionally fed into the Enlightenment because so many of them were intellectuals, and Spain didn't want them anymore because it was going Catholic. And so all these intellectuals ended up flooding into other parts of Europe and feeding into the advancement of knowledge and science and mathematics and everything. And same with the Muslims as well that fled southern Spain, not just the Jews. But, you know, so look at the ironic outcome of that. And, of course, the church is so anti-modernist, but yet they were part of starting that whole movement, you know, hundreds of years ago because of religious persecution, burning people at the stake and torturing them in the Inquisition, all in the name of religion and God.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Right. Yep.
How does that help? It doesn't advance humanity. It like you say, it holds them back.
Right, right.
Because I think this is something that I think Chris, going back to Chris Shelton as well, he's really passionate about. You know, he keeps appealing to that sort of garden variety Christian, let's say, that person who says, well, you know, my church, we don't abuse people. We everyone gets along. We help the community. We don't do any harm to anybody. We're good for our community and for the world. And my response is, yeah, but you're propping up a system, whether you're intentionally or unintentionally, that does abuse people. And eventually it's probably going to happen to you or someone that you care about. You're going to get burned. You're going to get abused. You're going to get scorched by that church. And then it's suddenly not looking so good. So eventually it'll catch up to that person. It may take years, but it'll happen to them.
Right.
And then it's suddenly not so good.
Yeah, I think obviously we focus on the fundamentalists and the cult side a lot more, but liberal religions have no idea how much they're enabling a lot of abuse. You and I have something in common. I got my degree in seminary. I got a master's degree before I got my doctorate in psychology. I thought I was going to be a minister, so we've got that in common.
Yeah, only I actually did it.
Yeah, you did. I didn't.
I spent 12 years in, you know, as a pastor.
Yeah, well, I just kind of substituted here and there. I never really got into it. For about 10 years, I was very, very liberal. And I preached in some liberal churches. I attended the most liberal church I could find. But here's the interesting thing. I look back, I think, that's amazing. Every one of those liberal churches I was involved with had at least one and as many as three ministers just during the time I was involved with them who sexually abused somebody or violated fundamental principles of consent around sex. That doesn't even count the financial abuse that happened.
Right. So but it wasn't limited to the Southern Baptists, in other words, the fundamentalists.
No, these were very, very liberal Methodist and Presbyterian churches that I was involved with in one way, shape, or another. Now, here's the interesting thing is those are just the cases I know of. I wasn't out looking. I wasn't like a detective. These are just ones that fell into my lap that I found out about.
Your experiences. Yeah. It just so happened to happen while you were in this context.
Yeah. So I believe it would be if I counted them, 6 sexual abuse scandals in those churches and at least 2 financial abuse cases. So that's a total of 8. And I wasn't even looking for it. How many more were there? And those are liberal churches. So liberals, don't tell me you're not abusing people and taking advantage. Your fucking minister is no more trustworthy than the Baptist one. And I wouldn't want my kids around a Baptist minister, a Catholic priest, or an Episcopalian priest. It doesn't matter. They can all be predators. And you're not facing the music. You're not governing yourselves. In fact, I dare say that if the Baptists and the Catholics properly governed themselves around sexual abuse and financial abuse, their church would collapse. Because so many of those alpha males, alpha God, that's why I mentioned my friend Hector Garcia's book, they got in that position because they like the power it brings. And when you've got that kind of power, you're going to abuse that kind of power.
It's rife for abuse, isn't it? You see that in cults as well as churches and other organizations, don't you?
Yeah, right.
It's a patriarchal system that feeds into that sort of abuse culture. And then it's easy to morph that into a full-on destructive cult like the Branch Davidians, David Koresh, Jim Jones. I mean, the Children of God, the list is almost endless in terms of Bible cults alone. And you don't have to be, as you say, a fundamentalist preacher. You can be a complete flaming liberal and in a way, ironically, be just as fundamental in your belief system and intolerant in a way of the fundamentalist who is going to rabidly disagree with you. So, yeah, it's like religion full stop. You got to look at it. I'm glad you brought that perspective out because I think there must be, I know there's people who that's their line, isn't it? Yeah, but. There's some good in it. Well, you're kind of dispelling that myth, aren't you?
Yeah. There's no good. Why do we need a fantasy? Why do we need to rely upon unreality, non-reliable means of understanding the way the world operates? What Episcopalian priest can tell you through his training how physics works? It's just ludicrous.
Yeah, it's not his field.
My contention is there's... Theology has not added one iota to our culture and to our understanding of the world ever. Tell me one single theology that helps you understand the way the world works. I've never seen one. Go back to Zoroastrianism. Go back to Judaism. Go back to Buddhism. None of those things tell us a thing about physics, about genetics, about biology, about reproductive health. Nothing. So what the fuck is it good for? Nothing more than infecting your brain with a parasite that's going to suck your energy out of you.
That is a really interesting perspective because when you see it that way, it sure doesn't seem like there is much use for religion full stop.
When I use the parasite metaphor for Mississippi, it works just as well for you because if you have a religion in you, you've got a parasite sucking on you just as much as a plasmodium for malaria is sucking the energy out of you.
Yeah, it's sucking the life out of you. That's a good point, too, because I remember when I was in Bible college, they used to have these lecture specials where they'd bring a speaker in and they would preach for the whole week. You know, you'd have to be in chapel every day of class. And this one guy they brought in one year was I can't remember what branch of science he was, but he was quite a well-educated PhD in science. And his whole talk every day was on the subject of, can you be a Christian and be a scientist? So to answer your question, what his answer was, well, we have to find ways to basically, we're looking for God in science. You know, so yes, we're not, quote, adding to science, but we're seeing God in everything. You know, so everything, they explain everything by saying, this is proof of creation. This is proof of God's amazing ability, blah, blah, blah. That's one way they get around that, isn't it? Okay, they're not adding in terms of scientific knowledge, but this guy was proclaiming, yes, you can be a Christian and a scientist. There's no conflict whatsoever because we're looking for God.
Hold on.
And we're seeing him.
Hold on just a minute, Clint. I'm looking out the window. I see Jesus in the clouds right now.
Get your camera then.
I don't see Jesus because I'm the high priest. You may not know this, but I'm the high priest of the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster.
Right.
Did you know that?
I did not know that.
I am.
Well, I might want to join your church.
I'm the only high priest there is. Now I see the Flying Spaghetti Monster in everything. I see his noodly appendage touching the leaves of the trees out there right now. And when I have pasta, I'm convinced that there is a God. It's called the Flying Spaghetti Monster. So there you go.
Pasta heaven.
What your scientist is saying is I find God. Well, I'm saying I find the Flying Spaghetti Monster. What's the difference? Yeah. I see Jesus in the clouds. We seek agency. We're constantly looking in our environment for agency. And it's a good thing if you're being hunted by a lion to be suspicious of the rustling leaves in the grass. If you're wrong, oh, no big deal. If you're right, then you can get out of there and escape the lion. Well, we're constantly looking for agency. And that's what that science is saying. It says, I'm looking for a ghost, you know,
ghost in the machine.
Ghost in the DNA. Yeah, in the machine. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And for him, he was able to reconcile that. And we all walked out of there going, man, this is amazing. Because I was a staunch evangelical at the time. This guy's got it all figured out. Yes, you can reconcile God and science. And, you know, he had no problem getting along with his atheist colleagues and all the rest of it. You know, so we thought, this is great. He's cracked it. You know, he's found the ghost in the machine.
He's been able to partition his brain off into the rational side and the supernatural side. So there you go.
How can people get a hold of you? You've talked about your various websites personally, sure. Or is it better to direct people to your sites if they're coming out of religion, needing help with religious trauma? Where should they go?
Well, don't come to me because that's why we have the volunteers and therapists. Yeah, go to recoveringfromreligion.org. If you've got a direct, you want to contact me directly for some reason, my email is daryl@recoveringfromreligion.org, spelled D-A-R-R-E-L, @recoveringfromreligion.org. Find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, all over the place. I would suggest that your listeners follow us on Facebook, follow Recovering from Religion on Facebook. Follow Secular Therapy Project on Facebook and on Twitter because we're constantly putting up really good information. You friend one of our pages, you're going to see something worth reading within days, probably, if not every day.
So it's a good resource. If you're not necessarily coming out of religious trauma, but you just want to keep abreast of what's going on with your organization. I was going to ask you, can people volunteer to become, you said you've got sort of like trained operatives who receive phone calls and things. How can people do that if they wanted to get involved in the organization?
Well, we are always looking for volunteers because we're growing so darn fast. We are literally only, I know it sounds bad, but it's actually a good problem. We're catching about 45 to 48% of the incoming chats and phone calls. But that means we're missing half of them. And we're working our butt off to catch the ones we've got. But remember, we're talking to people in India or Saudi Arabia or Australia. We're in all time zones throughout the world. So not all of our volunteers are on those time zones. So we need more volunteers. We're always looking for more volunteers. Go to recoveringfromreligion.org, hit the volunteer button, and then fill out the form on there. And then what happens next is you get an interview. Once you fill the form out, then we schedule you for an interview. And one of our interview volunteers will talk to you, try to find out why you want to volunteer, what you want to volunteer, what your skill set is, that sort of stuff. And then once you finish that and get into our volunteer database, then you start your training. It's self-directed training. It's your videos you watch and you ask some questions. And then once you're finished with all the training, then you get into whatever system you're volunteering for, maybe the phone line or the chat line. Or the local groups. We have local groups that meet all around the world. And then we do continuous training and we try to help you perfect your skills and develop your skills. And you'll find you really learn a lot of stuff. We're big on, I don't know if you know about street epistemology.
No.
Anthony Magnabosco is a huge trainer for street epistemology. And it's just a way of asking questions without getting into big arguments and to interact with religious people or anybody else that's filled with dogmatic ideas. So you need to find out about Anthony Magnabosco and street epistemology. He is excellent. And he's one of our volunteers that helps us. But he's got his own organization for street epistemology. And we try to teach our volunteers and encourage them to learn good questioning. Basically, Socratic questioning techniques is what it amounts to.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're not going to convince anyone by having a big argument with them, are you? Especially if they're struggling, maybe doubling down a little bit, experiencing some of that cognitive dissonance, but not sure what exactly they want to do. Maybe they're prepared to come in looking to chat, but then you find yourself in the middle of an argument. So what do you do then?
arguing with people doesn't change their mind. An old mentor of mine said, people do not argue with their own data. Now think about that. People don't argue with their own data. So the question is, how do you get somebody to generate their own data? Because once they've generated their own data, they won't argue with it. And that's what Socratic questions do. You know, how do you know Jesus is the only savior of the world? Are there any other possibilities? That's a Socratic question. And then the person has to generate their own data in answer to that question. Well, it may take them years to generate that data. It took you years to generate that data. It took me years. So we teach people to be patient, to use good questioning techniques, and don't argue, because arguing only makes things worse. It actually drives people deeper into their dogmatic beliefs and security of knowing that Jesus is the only thing I need for this lifetime.
That's true. They're going to double down, even if they're experiencing that cognitive dissonance. Yeah. That's one of the most common ways people deal with it, is to double down and come out swinging even harder. So that's a very interesting way to deal with that, for sure. Yeah. Well, listen, I don't want to keep you too long.
Yeah.
I am very interested to find out if I can somehow make it over to BC next year. I've been hearing all this stuff. So thanks to Jana Selby for somehow connecting you and me. Thanks for reaching out to me. I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation.
Good.
I know that there's a lot of great stuff coming up. I hope people can come to your conference as well, coming up in September, isn't it?
Right.
So there's a lot of ways. I'll put in the show notes ways to get a hold of your organization, as well as the links to your Facebook and other resources that you've got. So thanks for spending some time to talk with me, Daryl. I really enjoyed it.
My pleasure, Clint. Thanks for having me on.
I suppose you really do have to ask the question, as I asked Daryl, is there any place for religion? And on the face of it, you'd have to say, well, yeah, of course there is. A lot of people love their religion. They love their beliefs. They get a great sense of community, which is definitely true. I've seen, again, family members and friends who love their church, who love their community, and that's the support that they get. And on one level, I guess you could say, well, there's nothing really wrong with that. But then I'm reminded of something that David Hayward said. He said, you know, the thing about church is it's all wonderful, it's all good, and it's all great. And yeah, you can have community and all the rest of it until something bad happens to you or someone that you care about. And eventually, in my experience anyway, that will happen. You're going to get burned. You're going to get scorched by a church or by whatever particular religion you're a part of, or something's going to happen. You're going to get abused, whether it's sexually, spiritual abuse, whatever the case may be. Something is going to happen to you or someone you care about. And the fact is that the person who's sitting there in their church and loving life and everything else, they're still propping up a system that does a tremendous amount of damage to people worldwide. Churches and other kinds of religions as well, world religions and cults and all the rest of it. So you really have to step back and look at it. And then you got a guy like Daryl Ray, who is helping people to recover from religion, as well as putting people in touch with secular therapists. And the fact is, this is something I talked about with Bethany Carter, that Christian therapists, specifically Christian therapists, do a tremendous amount of damage. I'm sure there's some good ones out there, but the ones that are specifically saying your problem is sin and we got to get you into the Bible, we got to get you back in church, we got to get you back into the fold, that's what's wrong with you, and this is how you have to find the solutions, by reading and by praying, reading the Bible and all these other things. That's a completely different paradigm shift from a secular therapist who's going to look at you and treat your symptoms, your issues, especially one who understands what the damage that religion can cause. So this is something that you definitely need to look at if you're a person who is suffering from religious trauma syndrome. And in fact, this is something that in the next episode, in a couple of weeks, I'm going to be talking about with Tim Sledge. He's coming up as the next guest. We had a really good conversation. Again, another very wide-ranging conversation. You'll know him from his Twitter handle at Goodbye Jesus. He's written the book Goodbye Jesus. He's a former evangelical pastor of a very large church down in Texas. Now he's walked away from all of it, is an atheist, and is very active on Twitter. So it's a very interesting discussion. So come back in a couple of weeks with my talk with Tim Sledge. Then we're going to have another couple of weeks after that, a really interesting discussion with Brielle Decker, or Brielle Decker Blanchard. She was the 57th wife of FLDS cult leader Warren Jeffs, now in prison for molesting children. They were his brides, actually, as young as, I think, 12. They were actually married to him, and he consummated the relationship. Well, she was one of his wives, and she talks about how she escaped from this cult. That is a fascinating story. So after Tim Sledge, come back and check out Brielle Decker Blanchard's unbelievable story of escaping from the FLDS cult. All right, so I'll see you in a couple of weeks with Tim Sledge. Let me know what you think of this episode. Please do me a favor. Give me a review. Give me a rating on iTunes or Podbean or whatever platform you listen to the show. You can always get a hold of me. You can follow me on Twitter at MindShift2018. I will also put Daryl Ray's contact information in the show notes if you want to get a hold of him or his foundation. All right, tech, check back in a couple of weeks, like I say, with me and Tim Sledge. This has been a great conversation. Hopefully you've enjoyed it with me and Daryl Ray as we talked about recovering from religion. I'll catch you in a couple of weeks right here on Mindshift Podcast.